Coming up on Broadway Radios, this week on Broadway, we speak with Tom Hewitt. We also review Kinky Boots, Lucky Guy, Finks, and Buyer and Seller. There's lots more news, so please stay tuned. Hello and welcome to Broadway Radios, this week on Broadway for Monday, April 8th, 2013. My name is James Marino. On the broadcast this evening, we have Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books, the most recent being the Broadway MVPs, 1960 to 2010, the most valuable players of the past 50 seasons. His columns regularly appear at MTI, Critcherland, and Masterworks Broadway, as well as many other places. Hello, Peter.
Hi.
Hi. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist. His work appears at Talkin' Broadway and Broadway Stars. He's also a photographer whose work can be seen at Final Spot Photo and many other places around the internet. Hello, Michael.
Hello.
We have a special guest. His name is Tom Hewitt, and you know Tom because he has been on Broadway for a number of occasions. We'll run through a quick list here. The Sisters Rosenzweig, The School for Scandal, Chicago, where he was Billy Flynn like 4,000 times. The Lion King, Art, The Rocky Horror Show, The Boys from Syracuse, Dracula the Music, and Jesus Christ Superstar. Tom, you have a lot of thes in the title there.
I know. I should cut some of those. Bring it down to 75 words.
For another number of occasions here. Thanks so much for taking time out on this late Monday evening to chat with us.
I know, right? My partner, Ed Staudenmeier, he's on tour with Anything Goes. He was just left on a two-week. He was home for 2 weeks. He just left today, so, you know, I'm a little lonesome, so I'm happy to have somebody to talk with this evening.
Dog.
So we hear you play another Medea later this week. Is that what's happening?
I do. Yes, I play another Medea. Another Medea. Yeah, that's the name of the piece, and we are performing at the Duplex of all places. I perform tomorrow night, again on Sunday. The following Sunday, and then again on the following Wednesday.
I see. Maybe Tuesday at 9:30, Sunday the 14th at 4, Wednesday the 17th at 7.
7 o'clock. That's correct. Yeah.
And this, you said we play, but is it a one person show?
I'm using the Royal We.
The Royal.
Ah.
Yeah.
And it's, well, you were Pontius Pilate, so I guess you.
Exactly. I'm portraying multiple characters, so I say we.
Can you ever get that blood off your hands?
No.
And that blood, goes from Rocky to Dracula to Superstar,
I am stained with red dye number two.
Okay, now, so Tom, this is basically, to boil it down, it's a gay version of Medea.
You know, it is. I keep forgetting that, though. It's about a gay man. It's about an actor who's gay, and he's incarcerated. So the show is about him in prison recounting the events of his life that led him to prison that also parallel the myth of Medea.
Oh, okay. And so is presumably Jason is obviously a gay...
A man. Correct.
Is Jason involved with another man or with a woman?
Yes. Okay. He's involved with another man.
Okay.
Yes.
So do you have children?
We have children.
Mm-hmm. I guess you'd have to if it's Medea, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. Which adds another element to it. You know, it's not... children are precious for gay couples, I think. You know, sure. It's difficult to come by, sure, for us. And the decision to have children is a big one for us. So, I think it adds another element to that whole aspect of the story.
And we should probably hasten to say, unless I'm incorrect, this is a very serious... it's not a spoof of Medea.
It is not. It's very, it has its humorous moments. Sure. He's an actor and he's flamboyant and there are a few laughs, but let me say they are early in the piece.
Okay.
The laughs. Yeah, it's very serious. Yeah, it is.
Angels in America was serious, but funny, very funny at times.
Sure. Absolutely.
So your man has done you wrong?
My man has done me wrong.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And this is a piece written by Aaron Mark?
The prolific, extremely talented, and ridiculously young Aaron Mark. He's 26 years old. He's just great. He's a great kid. I really like him a lot. I like his stuff. I've had a long relationship with him for about, I guess, man, 2 or 3 years now. I've read some of his plays. Years ago, I was in a small film that he wrote and directed called Commentary, about a bunch of about people doing the video commentary to a film. Like, you know, they're watching the film. The camera is stationary on us watching the film and making comments, doing the commentary. It's really fascinating. It was kind of star-studded, too, like Alison Fraser and Leslie Kritzer, Jerry McIntyre, Chip Zine was in it. So it was fun, and I love his stuff. He's very contemporary, and I never get a chance to do that kind of stuff, that conversational stream of consciousness, up-to-the-minute contemporary dialogue.
So did he come to you and say, Tom, I've got a project for you? Did you say to him?
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. He's familiar with my work, and like, you know, he said, come and read this thing for me. And then he apparently, unless I'm mistaken, sort of wrote this Madea piece with me in mind.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So, I've been familiar, aware of it for a couple of years. We've done a couple of readings of it. And, you know, actors, we have downtime, and I always toy with the notion of a one-man show, as we do. It certainly lets you, flex your imagination muscles and allows for some flexibility. You don't only have to answer to yourself. Anyway, you know, I've always thought them a little bit, a little presumptuous, like, really? Like... Really, people want to come and see me do a one-man show? Really? So, I get whatever. Anyway, this kept presenting itself to me, and we did some readings of it. It took a little time for me to decide to do it because the material is really rough. You know, did I want to submerge myself into the events of the show deep enough to really explore them and flesh them out? And do I want to show these events to somebody else? You know, is this going to be something that people are going to want to see? So that's what this whole duplex thing is kind of about, to see if A, I could do that, and B, if people would actually want to come and see it. So it's kind of a first small step for us.
I want to point out that Aaron Mark, the writer, is somebody that our listeners might know of. He wrote Ben Rimmelauer's Patty Issues.
He directed it.
He directed it,
So mm-hmm. he's a very busy young guy.
He's a very busy young guy. He's very ambitious, and I'm old and lazy, so we're a good team. that's kind of how we got in the duplex, too, because Ben Rimmelauer's show, Patty Issues, is doing so well there that mm-hmm. they love Aaron, you know, so he's got a relationship with that place. So mm-hmm. it was, the staff is great at that place, at that duplex.
They really are.
Oh my God. They're remarkable. So nice and supportive and friendly. And so they let us do it. They let us do a show that the duplex is the last place on the face of the earth that you would expect to see another Madea.
Yes, I'll say.
Yeah. But they let us do it, and God bless them.
So of these Broadway shows you've done, what's the one that really stands out as the one you had the best time with?
Oh, my gosh. Well, the Rocky Horror Show. You know, that was just a big damn party, you know, from rehearsal to... It was just great. And I'll never have that experience again, to have that kind of relationship with the audience, to not know what was going to happen from one night to the next, to have the range of personalities from Dick Cavett to Lea Delaria. Mm-hmm. That was, I knew that I would not have. I cherished every second of that show, knowing that this won't come around again.
I'll never forget. I wish I could remember the specific line, but the night I saw it, you like had an exit line and you were walking off and it's like you knew that somebody was probably going to say something. Mm-hmm. And so you'd slowed down just a little bit. Ah. and then like as you got to almost to the exit, somebody yelled something and then you came right back with a comeback and you walked off and it was hilarious. It was so great.
Great anticipation.
Say it.
Say it.
What I loved about that production is that really honored the fans of the show. That's it really, and let you know right from the beginning that audience participation was certainly encouraged, because when you come out there and say, give me an R, give me an O, give me a C, you're saying to people, we want you involved. So, and it was just really quite nice to see everybody get involved and have permission to get involved right from the get-go.
Exactly. Yes.
But also, I think Tom and I discussed this once, the actors were very, very good at being able to keep it in control.
Yes, they were.
Mm-hmm. You know, yeah.
Yeah, it was challenging, and we had to figure that stuff out, especially early on. Jared Emick and Alice Ripley up there singing, there's a light over at the Frankenstein place, and it's supposed to be raining, and there are people with squirt guns, like inches from their face, while they're singing, with the like microphones and stuff, like, well, this just won't do, you know. Or the Leah Delaria as Dr. Scott makes her entrance, and people traditionally throw rolls of toilet paper, Scott tissue, and one night the stage was white with rolls of toilet. We had to stop, and so we with the cast would pick it up and throw it back to them, which caused chaos. So it took a little while to figure that stuff out.
We just have to put this in perspective here. I just want to go through this cast. Yeah, Dick Cavett, Leah Delaria, Jared Emick, Tom Hewitt, of course, Joan Jett, Alice Ripley, Daphne Rubin-Vega, Raul Esparza, Sebastian Lacaze, Kevin Calhoun, Deirdre Goodwin, Akio Nakasone from Rent, of course, Mark Price, Jonathan Sharp, James Stovall, Kristen Lee Kelly as a swing, and Jonathan Jeffrey Martin as a swing. I mean, It must have been out of control from day one.
Well, also that was Raoul's breakthrough role, too.
Yes.
It was, yeah. It was like in the days when I was like, you know, I don't know if I like musicals. I don't want to do musicals, says Raoul Esparza.
And then there's that whole Dick Cavett thing.
Oh, my God.
How do you deal with that?
How do you deal? It's Dick. Oh, Dick. Yeah, he's awesome. You know, so smart. But so sweet and accessible and nice and funny and just loved that job. God, he loved that job.
So I also think of Rocky as being you and the rest of the cast had the opportunity to break in a young Jordan Roth who had never produced a Broadway show before.
Yes, we did.
And you tell us a little bit about that.
I was going to acknowledge him when you said, you know, the audience participation, people had permission to participate. That was really Jordan's thing. He did that donkey show too, you know, prior to that, which is totally about audience participation. So he wanted to take that a step further. That was his, you know. I think the cast was a little resistant to it at first, you know, but he's the one that really, you know, Alice Ripley said it best. She said, yeah, the audience is like another character in the show, but they weren't there for rehearsal. it was sometimes a little bit challenging. And of course, the trick was, for me anyway, as far as audience participation goes, was to say the next scripted line.
Yeah.
That's, of course, what made it funny. So, but yeah, Jordan, he marketed it well. He, we had turnover. We had guest narrators, you know, people like Penn and Teller. Mm-hmm. And Gilbert Gottfried, you know, he that was sort of genius too on his part. He you could tell he's a young, smart guy, and
Did Teller narrate?
I doubt he did. You know, I imagine he had a subsidiary role as a narrator there.
Exactly.
That Penn did most of the talking.
Right.
So
I sort of remember their special performances added right around the Halloween time.
Yeah.
And that was probably a whole nother level of challenge for the actors on stage.
The audience participation and things that they would say would change seasonally. It would change. Luke Perry was a Brad for a while, so there was 90210 stuff just flying all over that stage.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
You know, it was hysterical. So you never knew. You never really knew what was going
to happen. I forgot he did that. I mean, it didn't run that long, but I guess...
It ran a year.
437 performances.
Okay, yeah, right.
Ran a year.
Yeah.
A little more.
Yeah. And a little brief hiatus there in the middle.
Yes, exactly.
Sure.
So back to Madea, or yeah. Another Madea, as we should say. It's at the Duplex, and we have a handful of shows left, so I guess we'll throw up some information on the website to go to get tickets and information about it, so you can visit the Duplex. Tom, thank you so much for joining us and sharing with us some of your fun stories. I appreciate it.
It's been a great pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right. You have a good night.
Good night.
Take care.
Bye.
Good night, fellas.
All right. That was Tom Hewitt joining us on a Monday evening, very late. But Peter and Michael got a chance to see the new musical, Kinky Boots. So, Michael, why don't you start us off with that?
Oh, I had... Do you guys often find that when you go to see a show with someone that you both have the same experience?
Sure. More often than not.
Yeah, I don't. Isn't that interesting? I wonder. I wonder why that is exactly. Because that was the case here. My friend and I. And my friend is a Broadway performer, by the way. At the end of Act One, I think we both thought that there were some fairly significant flaws in the show, but we still basically loved it and we're having an incredibly great, wonderful time and we're really caught up in the story. And then Act Two fell apart so completely in terms of Harvey Fierstein's book that at the end of it, we decided that it was really not a very good show at all. And that really pained me because I do think, first of all, I overall feel that Cyndi Lauper did a wonderful job in her maiden voyage as a musical theater composer and lyricist. I thought the songs were very interesting and very melodic, but, you know, in a new... you know, in a poppy way, but they functioned very well as theater songs. They really explore the characters, and I, you know, other than the usual thing that Peter and I have discussed on many occasions, there were a lot of false rhymes and non-rhymes in the lyrics, but I guess I've just had to make peace with that in shows that are set in the present day, because I recognize that so many songs nowadays, and especially pop type songs, do not have rhymes. But other than that, I thought it was a very, very, very praiseworthy score as a first effort, and even if it hadn't been her first effort. But the story is just, you know, as written by Fierstein, it's just mired in cliche and all this manipulative stuff that happens and plot points that make absolutely no sense whatsoever, just to kind of complicate matters and keep the story going and allowing you to have an act two. I did not see the film on which this musical was based, a British film. And I would like to see it at one point, because I'd like to see how much, if any, of the strangeness in the storytelling is in that. But I suspect a lot of it was introduced by Mr. Fierstein, because he tends to really do that. In a nutshell, it's a story. There are two central characters. There's this fellow named Charlie, played by Stark Sands, and he... his father ran a shoe factory, and Charlie makes some noise about getting away from the family business and moving to London to make his fortune, you know, doing whatever, something more creative. But then he winds up back in the factory when his father dies. And he does, in fact, take over running it. And it turns out that he really seems to like it. But unfortunately, the factory is dying because there's just not there's just not the demand for the shoes that there used to be. And there's questions of, you know, if it's going to close entirely, if, you know, if all of these people are going to be out of work, et cetera, et cetera. So that's his dilemma. And then he meets this drag queen named Lola, played quite wonderfully by Billy Porter. To make a long story short, Lola inspires Charlie to come up with this idea of making the factory viable again by being very specific and only manufacturing the kinky boots of the title, which in this case means really elaborate over-the-top footwear to be worn by drag queens. So those two get in cahoots together, Lola and Charlie, and they launch on this project. But you know, problems start in Act One, and I don't know. I mean, isn't Broadway supposed to be the place where the people who really know what they're doing are the ones that are doing it? Isn't it supposed to represent the absolute, you know, theoretically, hopefully, people at functioning at the highest level and the most talented people? So why is it that someone like Harvey Fierstein can't recognize that some of the stuff he's writing doesn't make any sense when people on all that chat, you know, just go and see it and point it out? For example, at some point in Act One, it's mentioned after the father has died and Charlie has taken over the factory, suddenly Charlie's girlfriend comes on with this guy who has this scheme to turn the factory into condos. And we are suddenly told that he had already discussed this with Charlie's father, and Charlie's father had agreed to it. All right, so now, first of all, why would Charlie's father have begged him, you know, and urged him to take over running this factory if he was already planning to sell it to be made into condos? And secondly, that plot point doesn't really ever come up again. And it's not really essential, because it doesn't matter what, if anything, the factory is going to become. The point is that the factory is failing and all these people are going to be out of work. So, you know, but introducing that, then people are sitting there saying to themselves, apparently everyone except Harvey Fierstein is saying to themselves, well, why would the father do that to the son? It doesn't make any sense whatsoever. So that's,
I'll jump in here to say that I have seen the movie, not for a long time, I'll grant you.
Oh, really?
Yeah, okay. But let me point out what happens in the movie that isn't stressed in the musical and should be, because this is a very valid point. The girl's lying. The father never had a discussion on selling the factory into condos.
Oh, okay. Well, did you feel like that was made clear in the musical?
By no means. By no means. I'm only explaining to you.
Okay. Well, then,
the movie handles it, and the musical wants us to forget about it. But your point is very well taken, and there's no question that that's something that should be stressed in the musical as well, because that would answer that question for you. Also, one of the things that happens in this show is the fact that he's in love with this girl, and by the time the show ends, he is not, and this gives him another reason not to be in love with her, because she lied to him.
Oh, okay. Well, thanks for clarifying that. That certainly explains it. Maybe Harvey didn't realize that he didn't make it clear that she was lying, but he obviously
I wouldn't be surprised if it was one of those things the show was running long and they thought they'd get away with it. It could very well be too.
And then in Act Two, I could go on and on, because it really everything just falls apart. But one of the most ridiculous things is, so they're going ahead, great guns, and they're making these boots for drag queens, and Lola suggests that his fellow drag queens can model the boots when they go to show the boots in Milan, rather than the expense of hiring models. And so blah, blah, blah. And then suddenly, out of the blue, with absolutely no preparation whatsoever, Charlie suddenly says, oh, no, I think we need to, you know, appeal to a broader market. I think we need to have these boots modeled by real women and sell them to actual women in addition to drag queens. And we're sitting there going, what? You know, I mean,
what's going on here, and again, this is a little clearer in the movie as well, is the fact that he is mortifyingly embarrassed by the fact that he is making these shoes for drag queens. He's never at home with it. He's always jittery about it. It's unmasculine. He doesn't want to associate himself with this element, but it's a case of, do you come to terms with it or don't you? And is it something to be ashamed of? It's interesting. At one point, there's Lola has a line that is not in the movie when somebody talks about drag and it's not mainstream, something like that. And he says, drag is mainstream. And you know, he's right. I remember seeing Chicago in 1975 and how astonished people were when Mary Sunshine took off her clothes and revealed herself as a man. I saw the original production of Chicago, I would think, about 8 times. And every time that audience was flabbergasted. Today, that character can't walk on stage for 14 seconds without somebody saying, it's a man. You know, so, I mean, it has gone mainstream. And there is, and I think that's a very good point made by Harvey. I didn't mind the polemic stuff as much as you, Michael, I have to say. But I like the fact that these two people from two different worlds did get together and find a common peace.
I'm sorry, you didn't mind what stuff?
Well, the polemic. You know, that there was a lot of talking about acceptance and forgiveness and
I just thought it was very, very heavy-handed. But also,
you're not the only one, by the way. I mean, I've heard this objection a lot to this show.
No, but also, again, and I also did not think that until the moment when Charlie suddenly said, we have to have women do this, I didn't think he displayed any discomfort. I didn't get that sense from the actor, and I don't think it was in the script. So maybe I missed it, but I don't know. Again, the person I was with had the same exact reaction, that it came completely out of the blue and seemed totally unmotivated and was only there to create a plot complication.
Well, as far as adaptations of movies go, this one I think is one of the more faithful. It definitely follows the template of the movie, even though I've given a few examples here now of where it varies. But nevertheless, by and large, it's a very faithful adaptation, as I remember. One thing that I really liked was the fact that in the movie, early on, Lola breaks her heel, and nothing is said about it. The camera just shows you the broken heel, and you are supposed to put two and two together that one of the reasons that Charlie comes up with the idea of making the shoes is because he knows that these heels break easily when men wear them, because men are heavier than women.
Right.
So Harvey establishes that very well by dialogue, and he doesn't rely on just our watching the shoe fall apart. And that may sound small, but it's definitely something in the right direction. So, yeah, I have to say, I like this show more than you, Michael. I do think that Sidney Lauper's work is very, very good, and I didn't see nearly as many false rhymes as you did. I did hear some false accents, yeah. But really, for a contemporary songwriter, who, by the way, says that she certainly grew up hearing cast albums in her home, and it sort of shows, you know. And I have a feeling she also took a great deal of advice from the people around her, which is so much healthier than the pop songwriters who come in and is going to show Broadway a thing or three, you know. So I think she really did try to listen to people around her, and that's why the score is so good, comparatively speaking, to other people who come in from that world. So it's definitely one of the most successful ones I've heard. I think it's well performed. I liked it. Everybody in it, really. I even the small parts, the characters were very interesting to me. So I think this is a successful show, and I think it's going to run a while, and I wish it well.
Well, I certainly agree about the score, and yeah, I mean, I wasn't counting the false rhymes. It seemed to me there were a few. It seemed to me there were a few occasions when a plural rhymes with a singular. Which,
yeah,
you know,
I remember that, right? Yeah. And it's funny, yeah. When I heard that one, I thought, you know, that could have been written differently so that it wouldn't have had to happen. But there was like four rhymes in a row, and one of them was a plural, and the other three were singulars. Yeah, I caught that. But, you know, I mean, I know a lot of our listeners here are throwing up their hands in disgust, saying, you nitpickers, what are you? No, I mean, think it's better when lyrics do rhyme perfectly, because I think people have a better time. They can understand the words much better. But nevertheless, believe me, the sins that Cyndi Lauper committed in this show are far fewer than most songwriters who come on the scene who haven't had any Broadway experience either.
So. Oh, one other thing I have to mention, and this really surprised me. I mean, Jerry Mitchell, you know, there's some really great work here, especially as a choreographer and also as a director. But I got the feeling that there were so many numbers that didn't build the way that they should and or did not end in a way that you know, that is likely to prompt applause. One way or another, I always felt like there was something that happened at the end of a number that that kind of made it fizzle and not get the hand that it deserved. And I thought that was really surprising and unfortunate. This character played by Annalee Ashford as a girl who works in the factory who winds up... well, she winds up sort of getting a crush on Charlie, and he eventually, you know, comes to appreciate her. But she has this absolutely fantastic number in Act One. She did a brilliant, brilliant job of it. The audience was absolutely in the palm of her hand. You know, the acting-wise and vocally, she was just really, really knocking it out of the park. And then it got towards the end of the number and it sort of built to an ending. And, you know, and then suddenly it built towards the ending and suddenly the music stopped and another character had a line of spoken dialogue, which Anna Lee's character then answered with a line of spoken dialogue. And then there was a chord and then the song ended. And I thought it got like one third of the applause that it would have gotten if she had, you know, ended it with a money note or something like that.
I agree with you there. That was quite regrettable. It reminds me, though, of something else involving these two characters. The girl he's with at the beginning that he's going to marry and the employee that he winds up with. It's very nice that in this musical, one's a brunette and one's a blonde, because in the movie, they're both brunettes, and you can't even tell from the other, I'm telling you. I mean, it's just amazing. You don't know who's who. So so at least the casting was good in that. But, yes, I agree with you. I was very surprised that that song got short-circuited.
Yeah, and really, because she was doing such a great job with it.
Oh,
the audience was just loving it, you know. Mm-hmm. Did you feel that?
Yeah, oh, indeed. One thing I want to say about Billy Porter, I had heard from day one that Billy Porter was sensational. And I got in my head that what that probably means is that he was tremendously over the top. And I was delighted to see he wasn't. This is a human being first and a drag queen second. And I thought that was really very important. It reminded me of Leroy Reams in Applause back in 1970, who was playing a gay character and wasn't over the top. And ironically enough, he did not get nominated for a Tony Award, while René Auberjonois, who was over the top at Coco, got the Tony, not just the nomination, but got the prize. You know, so it's nice to see that Billy Porter and, again, his director, of course, have made sure that this isn't just a screaming, out-of-control character. He's a human being, and there are going to be some people, I think, who are going to miss the flamboyance that they expect from this character, but it was really refreshing for me to see somebody who really was a human being.
Well, I agree 100%, and especially after having seen Billy in Angels in America, I'm not the least surprised. I mean, he really is a superb actor.
Yes, he is.
Yeah.
Well, you know, for a role like that to come along for Billy these days, he's quite a lucky guy, isn't he?
Absolutely, because it's been a long time since he's been on Broadway, you know. So I have a feeling, though, that line was said for a segue. Is that correct?
You know, nobody is more cheesy than I am. So, Lucky Guy opened up at the Broadhurst. Peter and Michael got a chance to see it. Peter, why don't you start us off on this one?
I liked it quite a bit. I know this play has gotten mixed reviews. People say, well, it's all right. You know, I liked it more than that. Maybe it's because I've worked in the newsroom for a long time, and I've seen the machinations that go on. It struck me as very real. At the Star-Ledger, I have seen people, reporters, jump on a big story like the Seton Hall fire that had happened, or for that matter, 9/11. I'll admit I didn't get into the office that day. I wasn't able to get to New Jersey. But I have seen reporters both in and outside the office, and this struck me as very real. And at the risk of being terribly sexist, and I really apologize in advance if I am, it doesn't seem to me like a play written by a woman. It has this real gritty underbelly, and I really applaud Nora Ephron for being able to make these characters very real to me. Ironically enough, by the way, not that he's a character, but Jim Wilsey is mentioned quite a bit in this play when he was the Daily News editor-in-chief, and he became the editor-in-chief of the Star-Ledger, and I was waiting for him to show up on stage. Boy, did I check my playbill. He doesn't. He's only mentioned. But take it from somebody who's lived this life. I thought she got it right. And by the way, I think Tom Hanks is sensational in the part. He has to play this reporter, Mike McAlary, who starts off like a house of fire, who really believes he's the sun and the moon, and he will have a very different type of comeuppance as the play continues. And he is going to be damaged as time goes on in one way or another. I don't want to be too specific, but I thought he got it all, and I was tremendously impressed. It's a wonderful debut. I liked him immeasurably, and I wish him only the best during this awards season.
So, Michael, what did you think?
Well, I certainly agree on Mr. Hanks. I mean, when was the last time he did stage? I didn't.
On Broadway.
Yeah, I mean, he's certainly never been on Broadway. But, I mean, I think, I believe he hasn't done any stage since very early in his career. And you would never, ever know it.
Yeah, pretty much at home.
I did think that there was a little bit of, a little too much yelling, but not only from him, from people in general, and so I maybe that was partly at the behest of George Wolfe, the director. And you know, I mean, don't get me wrong, there are many places when yelling was certainly called for, but I thought maybe there was a little bit more of that than there needed to be. But other than that, he seemed completely at home on stage, very relaxed, totally in the moment. I never saw him drop character for a second. And he, yeah, it seemed like really excellent casting. And, you know, there are probably things that he could have done that would have been easier and maybe more of an easy sell to audiences, although that certainly doesn't appear to have been a problem, does it?
Yeah.
It's doing very well. So, yes, nothing but praise for him. And I also agree with what Peter said about the I've briefly worked in newsrooms sometime in my life too. Nothing quite like that, and nothing on that level. But I think that it painted a very clear and believable picture of what it was like with all these old guard, you know, hard drinking journalists,
hard
smoking. Yeah, there's one or two really funny bits related to the smoking that I won't give away.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, it seems like a lot of them are Irish. And if they're not Irish in actuality, they're Irish in spirit. They keep going out to bars and singing these Irish drinking songs. and it was a very, very, very colorful era that
Michael,
before
anybody calls you racist, I want to bring up a point that in New Jersey, there was once a theater company called the Celtic Theater Company.
Mm-hmm.
And they did old Irish plays, and they did four a year. And I used to go all the time, see all four a year. And I'm telling you, inevitably, in the third act, somebody would come in drunk from a bar. I mean, you can say what you want, but I mean, so much Irish literature does involve people coming in a little inebriated, a lot inebriated, that type of thing. So I can certainly, it never was brought home to me until I went to the Celtic Theater Company, that this is something that certainly the Irish acknowledge as part of their culture, for better or worse.
Yes. And Peter, I forget, when did you come to New York?
What year did I come to New York?
Yes.
77.
Okay, so you were here for all of this period then too.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Well, it certainly seems to me that it's very accurate from what my memory is, just the general tenor of the time in New York and
yep.
and the whole, you know, I mean, just the references to Giuliani coming in and all of that stuff and the whole attitude towards crime, you know, and the way it was dealt with by the tabloids. And I did feel I liked the play. I felt like maybe it would have had maybe a couple of more drafts if Miss Efren had not died. There were some focus issues, I thought. The central event, in a way, is McCallery's coverage of the Abner Louima case, and that doesn't happen till Act Two. And then when it does happen, it's very powerful. But and then in Act One, there's a couple of stories that are really the central thing. But I also felt that there was maybe a little bit too much time spent on other stuff that wasn't as interesting to me as someone who's very interested in journalism. So I think it might have been honed better. But
does this seem like the same playwright who worked on Love, Loss, and What I Wore? I mean, you know, it's pretty amazing.
Oh no, absolutely, I really think she did an excellent job of. I wonder if she actually spent time in that kind of a newsroom. I wouldn't think so. Maybe early in her career. But I especially loved. I really loved the beginning of the play. It was very funny, and I thought that got it off to a good start. I thought maybe it got a little humorless as it went along, but you know, not to a terrible degree. And I also liked the ending a lot too. There were places in the middle where I felt it maybe sagged a bit. And I also, you know, I'm not sure it necessarily needed to be two acts. I think maybe it might have been trimmed and done in one act.
Given that Delia worked on Love, Loss, and What I Wore, I wonder why she didn't come in and work on this too.
Oh, that's an excellent point. We should note the incredibly strong cast. I think this was kind of like people heard, oh, Tom Hanks is doing a Broadway show, sign me up. Because we have Maura Tierney as his wife, Christopher McDonald, really, really excellent. And as I'm sure everyone has heard by now, Peter Scolari, with whom Tom Hanks appeared in Bosom Buddies, the sitcom Lothies decades ago. So it was so terrific to see them on stage together. Richard Mazur in a relatively small role.
Almost unrecognizable.
Yes, and in fact, I didn't recognize him until afterwards.
Me too.
Danny Master Giorgio, who was so terrific in Golden Boy. Stephen Tyrone Williams as Louima. And just really, really chopped drawer cast. So I think everyone should be proud of it. And I'm glad that it's... You know, I'm glad it's a decent, more than decent. I'm glad it's a good play, a flawed but very good play that Mr. Hanks came to Broadway in, rather than some, you know, star vehicle.
Well, a revival for that matter. You know, how many come in revivals? You know?
Well, exactly. Absolutely.
You know, so the fact that he took a chance on a new play when he knew there wasn't going to be much in the way of rewrites, that's pretty good.
Right.
Do you think that there have been any discussions anywhere in some dark corner between Fran and Barry Weisler to see if Tom Hanks can sing and perhaps go into Chicago?
He'd be great in that part.
Miss Sunshine?
I don't think so.
All righty. So moving on, Peter got a chance to see Finks at the Ensemble Studio Theater. Which is running through April 21st. We thought we'd cover it because you have two weeks or so left before it closes. So, Peter, tell us about that.
It's very good. It's written by Joe Guilford. And if the name sounds familiar, yes, you may have known his daddy, Jack Guilford, who was certainly in A Funny Thing Happened the Way the Forum in Cabaret. And his mother, Madeline Lee Guilford, was a wonderful producer and certainly moved heaven and earth to get Rags on some years ago. terrific people. They were very much into the leftist movement. And I'm going to interrupt what I'm saying to tell a personal story that when I was working for Theater Week magazine, they called me up out of the blue and said, we think you're a terrific writer. We'd love to talk to you about doing a story. So I went over to their apartment, and I fully expected that they were going to, you know, talk about their life together and their marriage. And not at all. What they wanted me to do was actually become an undercover reporter. I'm not going to tell you exactly what they wanted me to do, but they wanted me to go and examine something under false pretenses, to be very specific, to pretend I was going to write a puff piece about a certain organization and then write an expose. And as I said to them, the things I write are only light extemporanea. I mean, this is not what I do, you know. And here was the wonderful thing about it. What happened with the Guilfords is if you were on their side politically, yes, you gained points. But if you were not on their side politically, you didn't lose points. They understood that some people were not natively political in the way that they were, and they did not hold it against you. And every time I saw them after that, and again, this story goes back to 1987, every time I saw them after that, they were lovely to me. They never held it against me and all that. Well, anyway, this story takes place when both of them are very much in the movement during the time when there are going to be House and Un-American Activities Committee investigations. And it deals with the fact that as the play, and I'm sure Joe Guilford knows about this, given that it was his daddy and mummy, the fact is that Madeline seemed to be the more person involved in the movement than her husband. She really got him more and more into it. And her devotion to the cause is one reason why he would not name when the time came. You do see scenes of him early on being a tumbler. That's a term that I'm sure many of you know, but in case you don't, one of these borscht belt comedians who used to be up at Grossinger's and do all kinds of crazy things. You know, think of the guy at the party with the lampshade on his head, that type of comedian. And that's the way Jack Guilford is portrayed here. In a terrific performance by Aaron Sorotsky, a terrific actor and a wonderful performance. He gets it all. He really understands what a tumbler was in those days. We don't really have them as much anymore. But really, really a sensational performance. They're all very good. And while I will admit that it seems unfocused for the first 15 minutes, you don't know where it's going or who you're dealing with or why you're hearing these things, boy, when it kicks in, it really gets good. And so I don't feel like a fink at all for telling you that the beginning is a little uneven. But boy, stay with it. Don't you move, because it is going to provide you with many, many theatrical rewards and terrific performances.
Great. So as we mentioned, it's playing at the Ensemble Studio Theater on 549 West 52nd, almost in the river.
All the way
over there, March 28th through April 21st. So get down.
With an elevator that never seems to be working when I'm there, but it's only on the second floor, and the climb will do you a world of good.
Excellent. All right. The next thing up is Buyer and Seller, which is down at the Rattlestick. So, Peter, tell us about that.
Well, this is a fictional account, and the first 5 or 10 minutes is spent with Michael Urie saying to you, listen, this is just a play. I mean, this do not believe a word of this that ever happened. But this is inspired by that book that Barbara Streisand put out about gracious living a few years ago. And Jonathan Tolan's a marvelous playwright. I loved his Twilight of the Golds, his Broadway debut back in 1993. And I was sorry to see it close so quickly. And I knew that he would stick around and be a great writer. And he's certainly done a wonderful job here in fantasizing what it must be like to be in Barbara Streisand's house in the basement. Now, in the basement, what does that mean? Well, according to the book, she's actually built a little shopping mall type of thing, little stores that she likes to go into. She's the only customer. I mean, it's a bizarre little world that she has down there, apparently. Well, Jonathan Tolans has taken this idea and has run with it and has decided what would it be like if you were actually hired to manage that place downstairs, and how would you deal with Barbara Streisand when she comes down and talks to you? I mean, the kid's panicked. Of course, he's a young man. He's an unsuccessful actor. Here he is playing a very difficult role, in essence, being the person who has to stand up to Barbara Streisand when she negotiates prices. It's all her stuff. I mean, it's this fantasy thing, you know. So I will admit that I'm a little surprised that he takes umbrage about something and makes such a big deal of it that makes the whole enterprise for him, well, let's say, gets him fired. It was a little stretchy for me, and I didn't think that he would necessarily do what he did, and I didn't see any value in doing what he did. But by and large, this is a hilarious enterprise of a young gay man, and especially dealing with his partner, who has many opinions on who Barbara Streisand is and what she should be and how he should handle her and all that. And it really causes a rift in their relationship when he doesn't quite do everything that the boyfriend wants him to do. So, and Michael Urie's marvelous. He really is. This is a guy who was so good in The Temperamentals, and he gets a lot of temperament to show here, and he does it very, very well playing the boyfriend and, yes, the BS lady too.
All righty. So that is, as I mentioned, Playing Down at Rattlestick. And
Mike, did you see it?
Yes, I did. I thought that the partner, when Michael Urie was playing the partner, I thought that was my absolute favorite character. Because he was such a wonderful character, the way he like voices a lot of frustrations that a great many people have with Streisand.
You bet.
Yes, Michael Urie is a great actor in The Temperamentals. And also, Peter, did you get to see him take over as Bud Frump in How to Succeed?
Yes, he was terrific, wasn't he?
Yes, suddenly it had all the laughs back.
Yeah, I agree with that.
So I'll never forget how he almost single-handedly resurrected that show. It was one of the most amazing things I've ever seen.
And frankly, I didn't even recognize him because he was in that character so well. I mean, at intermission, I looked at my program and said, my God, this is he. I mean, and then I put it together. Yes, that is that face. But nevertheless, he was so different in that from what he was in The Temperamentals that he was really quite extraordinary.
Oh, yeah.
I have a friend who claims that's one of the best performances he has ever seen in his life. So so that's pretty impressive, too.
I'm sorry, which one? Frump or the other one?
Frump. Yeah.
Yeah, he really was. Well, you saw it. He was really great. I share Peter's admiration for Jonathan Tolins. I thought the play was very well written. My problem was, and even though they spent all that time at the beginning, as Peter said, saying how fictional it is, to me the whole setup was so silly that I could never really relax into it, because as unbelievable as it may be that she actually has this mini mall in the basement of her estate, which is absolutely true. To me, the idea that she would hire this guy, this actor, to sit there all day and basically wait for her to come down occasionally to haggle with her about prices, of things that she owns already, it just seemed a little too far-fetched to me, even for a very whimsical play like this. But, you know, having said that, there was a lot of humor in it and a lot of humanity also. And I think it did humanize Streisand. And people really seem to be enjoying it. The audience seemed very much with it when I saw it. So I would definitely recommend it.
You know, that's a good point about humanizing. I think that's a very good observation, Michael, because we have seen Streisand become an ice queen over the years. I mean, there was a time when she was a funny girl, needless to say, and that was her strength. We loved her off the wall, down to brass tacks comedy that she could do and did so well. Do you know what I mean? That type of thing, you know, and she was great at it. But as time went on, she didn't want to be that anymore. And to see her relax and have Tolins essentially make her a human being as opposed to this haughty person that she really did let her hair down when she went down into that basement was really something. I liked it quite a bit.
Yeah.
All right, that was Buyer and Seller at the Rattlestick down in Waverly Place, and it's playing through May 4th. So a few things in the news. We have some news tonight that Hands on a Hard Body, which we just talked about last week, is posted a closing notice for this Saturday night. I think we speculated last week that the box office numbers weren't very good. Was this a surprise to you guys?
No, not a surprise, but I'm saddened by it because while I did think that it was a musical that still could use a little work and be tremendously improved, its heart was in the right place. And something like this with no stars should not be penalized for having no stars and dealing with an unconventional topic. It was a very ambitious musical in its own way, and as a result, I'm very sorry to see it close so quickly and not getting the chance it deserved.
Me too. It makes me very sad to think that that kind of a show can't succeed on Broadway. I think I do agree with Peter that it certainly could have been improved, but I think even with the flaws that it has, it's still better than most new musicals that I see. Far better. I was just talking with some friends last night. It has lots of wonderful moments, but there is a song, and I don't know what the title is, but in which basically all of the characters lament the fact that the the America that they grew up with, the mom and pop store America has been replaced by, and then they sing the litany: Walmart, Starbucks,
all the franchises.
Yeah. And it's very, very sad and very touching because we all know it's true. And it's one of those, to me, it's always been like, well, it's so sad, but how can you combat that?
Yeah.
I mean, it's free enterprise. And, people realize that some people thought that the way to mass production and volume was the way to bring prices way, way down. But it just knocked out of business all of these, the mom and pop stores, whether they be bookstores or coffee shops or delis or whatever.
It must be 20 years ago that I read a story about a guy who went into Walmart and saw that they were selling items that he sold. I don't remember what they were, but what Walmart was selling them for was under his cost. I mean, he couldn't even remotely compete with them because they were charging less than he could buy them for before he put on his markup.
Right.
And while that is a good 20 years ago, I've never forgot that. And I was reminded of it certainly in this wonderful song that you're talking about.
So we have a little gossip and scuttlebutt from across the pond. Heather Headley is starring in The Bodyguard, or is she starring in The Bodyguard? Michael, why don't you tell us?
Well, someone who is a theater industry professional here in New York City apparently was in London recently and wrote that... Well, what he wrote verbatim is, it seems that Heather Headley, who is scheduled to play 6 performances a week of The Bodyguard, plays only 2 on average per the box office. Alas, she's not feeling well tonight, and some producer would bring her to Broadway, She was out most of the 2 Christmas and New Year's weeks, they told me. So, I don't know what to say. I'll tell you this.
7 people I know who have seen The Bodyguard, not one has seen her.
I have to say, I have been down on that woman since almost day one. I mean, I'm sure she did what they wanted in Aida, but I didn't like it. I thought it was all posturing and very little real emotion. So that's just my subjective response to her performance.
You know, Michael, I have to agree with you 100%. I didn't think it was a good performance at all. And this is one of those cases where when Ben Brantley raves about somebody, the Tony voters follow because they feel that Ben Brantley must be right. And what was really ironic is that year at the Tony Ball, wouldn't you know, I wound up sitting at the Headley table. That's where they assigned me. And it was just so awkward for me because, not that she knew that I felt that way, but nevertheless, I mean, I just felt so eerie, you know, being in the presence of somebody who I didn't think was as good in the show as Ben Brantley did. And there I was with her family, you know, of course, having a wonderful time and everybody's celebrating and all that.
Yeah.
And I really couldn't be a part of it in the way that I really wanted to.
Who was she up against that year?
Well, that's the thing. She won it over Toni Collette in
Wild Party.
Yeah, who was just phenomenal.
I agree.
So that was another thing that I held against Miss Headley. And then on top of that, then she immediately started to make noises about how she. I mean, I don't remember the exact phrasing, but she wanted to get away from Broadway
absolutely
as quickly
true
as possible and become yep a pop star.
Right.
So I've never, you know, I have had that chip on my shoulder for ever
me
since
too
Aida. And this when I saw this this item we're talking about, this tweet or this Facebook post, I believe it was, I emailed it to James and I said it's epidemic because so many cases lately of people who seem unwilling or unable to do 8 a week of shows. I mean, it's really it's I think it's just terrible.
We should all line them up and have Stritch give them a talking to.
You know, I mean, some people say, you know, maybe it was always wrong to expect people to do 8 a week, but I don't know, they did for decades and decades. I don't know if I mentioned this, I just interviewed Janice Page, who is 90, turning 90 this year, because she just did an AIDS benefit in Los Angeles, the annual STAGE, STAGE benefit. And I brought it up because she was talking about Pajama Game and saying how she really noticed, at least as far as she was concerned, how much richer the character of Babe became over the period. You know, I don't remember now if she did it for 1 or 2 years, but even if it was just a full year, you know, doing it 8 times a week for all that time, how much richer the character became. And I said, well, you know, you may be aware that doesn't happen so much anymore. People are not in show. Nobody's ever in a show for 2 years anymore. I mean, hardly ever.
Well, not a star.
That used to be right. Yeah. Not a star. Yes. Thanks for clarifying. And you know, a 6-month contract is certainly not unheard of. And then on top of that, they so many people, not everyone, but so many people tend to miss so often. And she said, and we're not only talking about illnesses and vocal damage, we're talking about people taking off to do other gigs. Kelly O'Hara has been in and out of Nice Work If You Can Get It, I don't know how many times, to fulfill other obligations. Peter mentioned how Audra McDonald, you know, couldn't seem to do 8 a week of Bess, but she would leave and then she would go do concerts in New Jersey. And Janice Page said, in my day, it would never, ever, ever have occurred to us to take
off
a week.
That show. Shirley MacLaine was certainly glad that Carol Haney took a night off in that same production.
Oh, right. But actually, that just points it up, because the fact that Carol Haney missed was like, you know, that just didn't happen. I mean, it was, oh, my God, somebody is missing a show and the understudy's going on. It was like front, you know, even if she hadn't been
sure
playing, it would have been big news. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I don't know what to say. And, you know, please, every case is different. I'm sure in some cases that the absences are justified. But as a general statement, I think something really, really bad is happening.
You know who shows up 8 times a week every week?
We're ready.
For the last 25 years?
Mm-hmm.
Phantom. He shows up.
It does.
So
somebody, Ken Cantor, who's with Phantom, brought up an excellent point. Think of the year you started going to Broadway. Okay, Michael, what year did you first see a Broadway show?
69.
Fine. Okay. 69. Subtract 25 from 69. We get 1944. Okay? No, here's my point. You know, a kid today who wants to start getting interested in Broadway shows can see a show that's 25 years old. Imagine if you could have seen the original production of Oklahoma. you know, which was already a year old at that point. But I mean, it's pretty interesting to think along those lines, you know, about what long runs mean today, that people can catch up on things like that. So it's pretty pretty interesting to me. You know, I would have been able to see On Your Toes, the original production, when I started going, because I started going in 61. So that really brings home how long Phantom has been running.
Well, and I know James was nice enough, I think, to bring it up, because I mentioned that I went this past Wednesday to Tony's Dinopoli restaurant on 43rd Street. They have they've become known for having really wonderful portraits of Broadway stars. I think almost always in character from their shows by this wonderful artist named Richard May. And in this case, they unveiled a portrait of Phantom. Actually, it's a portrait of the Phantom and Christine in honor of the that show's 25th anniversary. And so I went to the unveiling, and Hugh Panaro, who's the current Phantom, was there, and a lot of the cast, actually quite a large percentage of the cast. So that was great. And also, we should mention that that Layla Martin was Madame Giry when the show opened, and did it for how long, Peter?
Ooh, I don't know. She was there for a while, wasn't she?
Yeah. So there are, you know, there are still some of the old guard, and I personally revere those people. I really do. And we should mention, since I criticized Harvey Fierstein earlier, as a performer, he is incredible. Aside from being very, very talented, he's incredibly dedicated, and apparently made a point when he was in Hairspray of showing up every single night. I think he literally missed half of one performance because he was so ill. But other than that, he did not miss at all.
Not just that. But
and
he also,
yes, he had
pictures.
His,
yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, he had a, well, you probably know the details. He had some kind of a wall of, wasn't it called a wall of shame?
It was all the 8x10 photos of the people in the cast. And your picture was allowed to stay up until you missed a performance, and then you were taken down. So it really was a way of indicating to people, we're serious about this. We want you to be here. I want you to be here, and you have a responsibility to be here. And if not, you know, you will not be on that wall anymore. And there was a bit of shame attached to not being on the wall.
Yes. Well, you can't stop the beat.
Nope. Nope.
All right, so we're going to wrap up here tonight, but we have some sad news to bring you on two fronts. Jerry Scott is a performer, and Michael wanted to say some words about him. He has passed away.
Yes, he was very deeply loved by, I'm going to say, you know, without any kind of exaggeration, thousands and thousands of people mm-hmm. who heard him perform and play for others brilliantly and beautifully in piano bars all over the city for more than 40 years. Mm-hmm. He played for me many times. And he, you know, almost always, well, actually, yeah, like 99% of the time without music. He had an incredible repertoire in his head and was able to immediately just play something in whatever key you wanted. Any show tune, certainly, and also, you know, standards and pop songs. The list, partial list of places he played in included, he started at the Candy Store, and then he was at the Regency, Nickel Steakhouse, the Painted Pony, East 5-3, Waverly, Oh Johnny, Tattoo, Rhapsody, Rosemary's, Ruby Fruit, One Potato, Nino's Tuscany, Caterina's, Butler's, Danny's, which is no longer there on 46th Street, but that's where I really got to know him, and Parnell's. And he really was the greatest, and I'm he's going to be so missed. It's been a very sad week on the piano bar circuit. I'll tell you that.
Also, Peter just got in. We're recording Monday night, the 8th of April, very late in the evening, because Peter just returned from the Marty Richards celebration. So Peter wants to tell us.
Yeah, celebration is exactly what it was. And Cheetah Rivera got up there and said, this is not going to be a dour evening. This is going to be a celebration. We were all in agreement with that. She started off, of course, doing all that jazz because Marty Richards was a mover and shaker in Chicago. And, of course, wound up eventually winning an Oscar for it, too. Liz Calloway was there to sing Not While I'm Around. Len Carey, you know, a lot of people said, boy, Len Carey really ruined his voice from Sweeney Todd. Well, it's come back because he did The Barber and His Wife and Pretty Women, and it was sensational. The audience went crazy for it. Victor Garber came on to do Joanna from Sweeney Todd, beautiful rendition with that wonderful wrong note, da 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 da, that wonderful note that is just as delicious as bittersweet chocolate. He did it beautifully. Marin Macy came on to do Never from On the 20th Century. And if I had stayed, I would have heard Katie Huffman do No Man Left for Me from Will Rogers, Sharon Wilkins do Olden Profession from The Life, Jack Noseworthy, I Cannot Hear the City, and Tamatha Caston, a name I don't know, doing I Want to Go to Hollywood from Grand Hotel. I guess Jane Krakowski couldn't make it. But Marty was an amazing producer, not just because of those shows, but also he was a very important building block in Broadway Cares, Equity Fights, AIDS. He was really in the forefront there of making things happen. And I dare say the organization would have had a much harder time, if not an impossible time, for happening if indeed it weren't for his tremendous efforts on the part of getting that going. He knew the importance of that. So a terrific guy. I had a wonderful experience interviewing him once at a Friar Club luncheon. He couldn't have been sweeter. He couldn't have been more gracious about taking the time to answer each and every question that everybody wanted to ask. And it was quite a shindig. And here was the thing. He left money saying, I want a celebration. And we had filet mignon, and we had open bar. And, I mean, it really must have cost, I dare say, six figures, because the place was packed, the Edison Ballroom. There were hundreds of people there.
Wow.
And it was all on Marty's cuff. So, thank you, Marty.
He would have enjoyed going out like that.
Yes,
and he planned it, I guess.
Yes, he certainly did, because there we were.
Well,
all right.
I may have mentioned before that I'll never forget the Oscar night when Chicago won so many awards, and he came up at the end with Rob Marshall, and they just had an amazing moment, and that was such a culmination, you know, of the journey of that show, and him with it. That was a really, you know, because I mean, whoever, you know, I still can't believe that. Can you still believe that Chicago happened as a film that was? That was that good and won that many awards in that, you know, so many years after it was on Broadway. It's just,
well, at the risk of blowing my own horn here, I'm going to say something. I have a book coming out on May 28th called Strippers, Showgirls, and Sharks. And that refers to Gypsy. That refers to Follies. That refers to West Side Story. And the book is about musicals that lost the Tony Awards. My last chapter deals with Chicago because my point is, hey, Chicago got shut out in 1976, didn't win beans, and who would have thought it would have had a renaissance the way it has? Who knows? Maybe some of these other shows in this book will have the same type of renaissance, and I can only hope that they do.
All right, so what's coming up for you guys this week before we sign off? Anything exciting?
Motown.
All right.
Yeah. I'm hoping to see Tom Hewitt in another Madea tomorrow night, so... looking forward to that. And,
I'm going to the assembly parties. I'm also going to Cabrini College in Pennsylvania to see a reading of a play that I've written. So it's very nice that they're doing it. So God love them. And we'll see how the students do out there on Thursday night.
Oh, we should mention that this Friday is a big Stephen Schwartz celebration, the New York Pops at Carnegie Hall, with a really great cast, including, really one of the, maybe the Broadway star of the moment, Jeremy Jordan. Mm-hmm. He just seems to be getting, like, becoming really huge.
Yeah.
So that people are very excited about that.
All right, so we'll wrap up there, and we'll come back to you next week and report on those things that we just talked about, hopefully. So I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these podcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe button there. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you, so you won't miss anything. If you would be so kind as go to iTunes and leave some feedback, because the more feedback that we have on iTunes, the easier it is for other folks to find the show and to grow our audience and make it a little larger. Some of the things that we've talked about today are linked on our show page at BroadwayRadio.com. And I want to thank Broadway World Radio for playing us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. So on behalf of Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radios This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye, everybody.
Simon from Clacton.
Let's make boots.
To new beginnings.